will come in or make themselves known. A lot of our neighbors here are homeless, and they, because of that, they will ask for money or they'll ask for rides. Tonight, if you get asked that, please do not give any money. Please do not give a ride. It also is our rule here that when the time is over and we're going to our cars, gentlemen, would you please make sure that no young lady leaves the building by herself, that she is escorted to her car. Bathrooms are ones right back through that door right there. And if you need, there's a one go down this hallway and it turns, goes about halfway. It's about even with me right here in a hallway that direction. So that's where another restroom, ladies' restroom, is on down and around a corner. So I want to thank Jody and Jacob. Jody for the food tonight. She provided the Frito pie. I think Al provided the jalapeno peppers. So, by the way, what'd you say? Yes. Okay. By the way, my understanding is jalapeno peppers are really good for COVID. So, helps your immunity. I have no idea if that's true or not. I'm just kidding. So, okay. I want to thank Jacob for setting up for us and getting things ready for us here. And appreciate all his that he does for us to make this happen. Is there y'all want to talk about Halloween? And then Drew has an announcement. That's it?
That's it for the Halloween.
Okay. Drew? Loud.
Be loud.
Oh, get wrong. This Saturday.
Louder.
At 6 o'clock, we're having a open
car
contest.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. I not part of that, but at 6, we'll be carrying pumpkins, and at 7, we'll be watching pumpkin pumpkins with popcorn and drinks. And so if you have any questions, I'm not a guy, talk to Organic or Gordy.
Wait, do I have a question? Gordy has a question.
Hold on. Okay, what? Go ahead.
Wait, not Miss Gordy.
Hold on, you might answer your question.
Not Miss Gordy.
Bring your own pumpkin.
Thank you, that was my question.
Yeah.
So,
and any other questions, please direct to Courtney McGuire.
Okay, let's start with 60 seconds of silence just to prepare ourselves. Jacob will jump up here in a minute and record it. Well, is it recording now?
Yeah, it's easier to go out and crop your instructions at the beginning.
I see.
Just
okay. Now, beloved, I just ask that you pause. You actually make a pause in your life right now, in that you attempt to be as present to His presence as you can. That is to say that I wholeheartedly believe that He is present with us and wants to do things among us. So I'm going to ask that we be silent and still for 60 seconds. Offering ourselves to Him. Ready? Go. Thank you. I would challenge you to find a time during your week where you attempt to do some silence up to maybe 15 minutes and see if you can accomplish that. I do think that there are things that come from our willingness to make ourselves present to Him that are invaluable and will come no other way. So let me encourage you, invite you to do that. Okay, tonight we're in 1 Samuel chapter 6. I'm going to invite you to silently read chapter 6, starting at verse 1, going all the way through chapter 7, verse 2. Chapter 6, verse 1, all the way through 7, verse 2. Now listen to me before you read. I want you to watch for, how many questions do you find in our reading tonight? How many questions, actual and implied, how many questions do you find in our reading tonight? Actual and implied. Ready, go.
Chapter 6.
6 all the way to chapter 7, verse 2.
First Samuel,
Okay, now one of the things I just did to you is an exercise in how you can study the Bible on your own. I cued you to look for questions. Now you can do that to yourself sometimes when instead of reading and just reading and not really looking for anything, and you're reading for reading's sake, which I'm not against that at all. Sometimes it's helpful to say to yourself, okay, I'm gonna watch for all the verbs, or I'm gonna pay attention to all the names, or I'm gonna look for, and you name something. It helps you have greater curiosity as you read. Now, I cued you for the questions because we're going to discuss the questions tonight. This is a long text, a long narrative, and there's unbelievably hundreds of things going on in this chapter. So, but what we're going to pick on is just the questions. What I'm going to do first, my proposal is to do this. I just want to walk through the chapter and just sort of try to explain some things. And then we'll go back and we're going to look at the questions. But here's what we're going to try to do tonight. I'm not saying we'll get it done. It's an attempt, and it may be a failed attempt. It may be an experiment that fails so badly we will never do it again, or it might be something that has some success. My hope is that it will. Now, here's part of our problem when we do Bible study. When we do Bible study, we bring all of our intellect and all of our, all the rules of grammar, all our understanding about how you work with literature, and we study it. All that's fine, but the problem is that we never go on to let it study us. And that's really what Scripture is supposed to do. It's really supposed to examine us. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to use the questions tonight as a way of letting Scripture examine our own lives. So let's just walk through it first and just talk about some things here, and then we'll go back and look at the questions. When the ark of the Lord had been in Philistine territory, 7 months, the Philistines called for the priest and the diviners and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it back to him," or back to its place. Now the actual Hebrew reads this way: "Tell us how we should send him back to his place." It doesn't use the "it." I could not find one English translation that translated it "him." So I don't know why none of our translations tonight use that, but that the actual Hebrew does say "him." Tell us how we should send him back to his place. Now, the Ark of the Lord had been in the Philistine territory for 7 months. Now, I was just trying to think, okay, 7 months of catastrophe. I mean, one after the other. The ark has visited 3 of their 5 cities and basically decimated each city. So much so that the third city that the ark was taken to, the first response as they saw the ark coming to Ekron, they said, "What, you guys trying to kill us?" It's like, no. 7 months. I think we have been fighting or readjusting, maybe I should say it that way, readjusting life because of COVID for 7 or 8 months now. Is that accurate? I think somewhere in the middle of March, we got spring break, and then they extended spring break, and then once came all the lockdowns and things like that. That was about 7 months ago. You know, for me, I don't know about you, but that feels like an eternity. Like it's been years since we've been wrestling with COVID. So you can imagine how the Philistines felt wrestling with the conditions that the ark was creating for them in their cities. Of tumors, plagues, sickness, and death. Lots of death. So here they are 7 months into it, and Man, they so much want to get rid of it. They are so ready to move the ark out of their land, out of their country. And so they call for the priest and the diviners. Now, the diviners are people who interpreted symbols as a way of interpreting what the divine wanted, or what the divine realm, what pleased them. So sort of two different classes of people that are dealing with spiritual things, priests and diviners. And so they ask the question, what shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it back to its place. And they answered, if you return the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it back to him without a gift. By all means, send a guilt offering to him. Then you will be healed, and you will know why his hand has not been lifted from you. Now, again, there's a struggle in the translation of that last part. Then you will know, you will be healed, and you will know why his hand has not been lifted from you. In that last sentence is the Hebrew word for ransom. You will know that you've been ransomed. So it's interesting that we get most English translations is what I just read, is that you will know why his hand has not been lifted from you. But it creates a little bit of struggle of understanding what is exactly going on. Now, where's this idea of gift come from? If you return the ark of God of Israel, do not send it back to him without a gift. By all means, send a guilt offering to him. There's two things happening there. One is, one of the things you need to know is that behind this scene, behind this story that you're hearing, the Philistines are very informed about the Exodus story. You know, you'll start seeing it here in a little bit, but they're very informed about that story. And they know that when the children of Israel left Egypt, they left with gold, with gifts from the Egyptians. And so most likely that's shaping what they're thinking now, is that, you know, we're wanting to send this ark out, get it out, send it away, like Pharaoh wanted to eventually send the children of Israel away because of all the plagues that was happening to Egypt. And so, but how did Pharaoh do that? Well, he sent them with gold. Okay, but then there's this word guilt offering. Now, the idea behind that is that they are discerning that because of all their suffering, they have offended this God of Israel, they have offended him. They are guilty of some kind of offense. And so they want to appease him. And so that's this idea of gift offering, or guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and you will know why his hand has not been lifted from you. The Philistines asked, this is verse 4, what guilt offering should we send to him? And they replied, 5 gold tumors and 5 gold rats, according to the number of the Philistine rulers, because the same plague has struck both you and your rulers. Make models of the tumors and of the rats that are destroying the country, and give glory to Israel's God. Perhaps he will lift his hand from you and your gods and your land. Notice, lift his hand from you, your gods, in other words, their supernatural world, and your land. It's, in other words, everything you got. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh did when Israel's God dealt harshly with them? Did they not send the Israelites out so they could go on their way? Okay, now, just backing up just a little bit. Why 5 and why gold and why tumors and rats? Why that? Well, the 5 represents the 5 cities of the Philistine nation or tribe. And so essentially what's being said is show your complete submission to this God. All of you. This involves all of you. So that's what the 5 is that it's this wholehearted, complete, involving everyone kind of surrender to this God. Now, gold is the representative of saying that this God has great worth. We've come to see that he's great and mighty, so he has great worth. We're going to give him the best that we have, and the best that we have is gold. And then they're going to make models of tumors and rats. Now, also, I think I told you, I don't remember if I told you or not, but that Hebrew word for tumor can also be translated hemorrhoids. So that would be interesting to make a model of that, but anyway. Thanks, Al. Okay, but why that? Okay, we got the number five is to show complete surrender. The gold is to show absolute worth. This is what you are worth. We're recognizing that. And then why tumors and rats? What they're trying to do is give back to God the plague that he has given them. And that's really a plea for mercy. They're really making a plea that this God of Israel, would have mercy on them by handing him back the things that he has given them. Okay. Verse 6, why do you harden your hearts? Okay, verse 7. Now then, get a new cart ready. In other words, build something new. Don't use an old one, build a new one. With two cows that have calved and have never been yoked. Now you're about to hear a brilliant plan. This is really brilliant on their part. Get two cows that have calved and have never been yoked. Hitch the cows to the cart, but take their calves away and pin them up. Take the ark of the Lord and put it on the cart, and in a chest beside it, put the gold objects you are sending back to him as a guilt offering. Send it on its way, but keep watching it. If it goes up to its own territory towards Beth Shemesh, then the Lord has brought this great disaster on us. But if it does not, then we will know that it was not his hand that struck us, but that it happened to us by chance. Okay, now here's the brilliancy of this plan. They're thinking, okay, we still want to test this to make sure that this is God that's doing this. So what they do is they get two cows that have just had calves. And now if you take a calf away from a mama cow, what's she going to do? She's going to try to get to that calf, right? Okay, so in other words, if you put two cows that just had calves and you take the calves away and you pin them up, plus these are cows that have never been yoked. They don't know what a yoke feels like. That's going to be foreign to them, and they're going to resist it. Okay? In other words, their movement is going to become real erratic in an attempt to get the yoke off of them. Okay? But what they're saying is that if we put all that as condition, and yet the cart goes to the Israel territory, then we know what's happening is that the God of Israel is driving that cart. That something, it's not, what would be natural is for those cows to try to find their calves. What would be natural is for them to try to buck off or shake off the yoke. But if instead this cart just turns and goes to the Israel territory, then we know that all of this has been being done by this God. So they want to make sure. In other words, that's that last sentence. We don't want this to be something that's just happened to us by chance. We want to know whether this was Israel's God or not. Verse 10, so they did this. They took two such cows, hitched them to the cart, and pinned up their calves. They placed the ark of the Lord on the cart, and along with it the chest containing the gold rats and the models of the tumors. Then the cows went straight up toward Beth Shemesh. This is about 7 to 9 miles kind of southeast from where they are right now. It is a village that's sort of in the highlands, and it is an Israeli village. In fact, it's scholars called it a Levitical village. In other words, many Levites lived in this village. And it probably is the closest village to where they are right now in terms of Israeli territory. So they went straight up towards Beth Shemesh, keeping on the road, lowing all the way. Now, you know, are they calling out, the cows calling out because they're missing their calves? Is that it? Or is it because they're being driven? And a lot of rabbis would say that the reason why they're lowing, they're mooing, is because they're being driven. You can't see the driver, but God is driving these two cows. Notice they did not turn to the right or to the left. That is to say, this is so unnatural that it's supernatural. The rulers of the Philistines followed them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. Verse 13. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were harvesting their wheat in the valley. And when they looked up and saw the ark, they rejoiced at the sight. The cart came to the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. And let me stop right there before I go any further. Now remember, behind all this going on is the Exodus, the story of the Exodus. The Philistines are very mindful of that story. So isn't it interesting that the cart comes to a man named
Joshua?
Who was it that led the children of Israel into the promised land?
Jesus.
Well, Joshua is the Hebrew word for Yeshua. So Jesus. Yeah. So it's just, here it is. Here's another echo of the Exodus story. The cart came to the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh, and there it stopped beside a large rock. The people chopped up the wood of the cart and sacrificed the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. The Levites took down the ark of the Lord together with the chest containing the gold objects and placed them on the large rock. On that day, the people of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices to the Lord. The five rulers of the Philistines saw all this and then returned that same day to Ekron. Verse 17, these are the gold tumors the Philistines sent as a guilt offering to the Lord, one each for Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. And the number of the gold rats was according to the number of Philistine towns belonging to the five rulers, the fortified towns with their country villages. The large rock on which the Levites set the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. Okay, verse 19. Now here, okay, that we wish the story could end right there. It's a great story. Woo! Yay! The ark is home! Okay, all right. Verse 19, but God struck down some of the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death because they looked into the ark of the Lord. Now let me stop here. The number is controversial. Some translations say 50,070, and other translations say 70. Now why the massive difference? 50,070 or 70. There are some manuscripts that have the 50,070. They're very ancient. And there's some who have just 70. Now, scholars who are studying this, and first of all, I don't want to spend a lot of time. The number doesn't matter. To this village, it was a great loss, whatever it was. And more than likely, there wasn't 100,000 people in this little village so that, you know, they could lose half their population of 50,070. The point that some scholars say is that the reason why 50,000 even shows up is to communicate how huge this loss was to this village. If it was a small village, the loss of 70 men would be catastrophic. Anyway, God struck down some of the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death because they looked into the ark of God. Now, beloved, this is a Levite village. There's Levites that live here. They should know. They should know better. And because they live there, the people that they live with should know better. Okay, first of all, who in Israel, in Hebrew thinking, who is it that gets to really see the ark once a year? The high priest. Once a year on the Day of Atonement. He's the only one that's supposed to see the ark unless God instructs the Levites to carry it somewhere into battle. Okay? God had not instructed Hophni and Phinehas to take the ark into battle. So it was an incredible loss. The ark was lost as well. So only the high priest is supposed to have eyes that see this box. Not to mention that somebody opened the lid to look inside to see what was in there. In other words, they had a question as to what's inside here. Now, what motivated that question? Could they be asking themselves, okay, did those bad Philistines, did they mess with our box? Did they mess with our stuff that's in here? And they could be checking that out. Or it could be just out of sheer curiosity, just to satisfy their own mind. Gee, I wonder what's inside this. Now, personally, this is just me personally, I think it's curiosity. Because to me, for them to lose their life over this meant that what they were trying to do was satisfy themselves, not God. The people mourned because of the heavy blow the Lord had dealt them, verse 20. And the people of Beth Shemesh asked, who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? To whom will the ark go up from here? In other words, we need to get rid of this thing. It's too dangerous. By the way, let me just stop at this point. Do you realize, now, I may create tons of questions here. So that's okay. You buy the coffee and I'll talk to you. But do you realize there's an element about God that makes him dangerous? You know God's dangerous? Do you realize, you know, you can't control him. He won't let you control him. He will not let you manipulate him. That makes him dangerous. That makes him dangerous to all the designs and agendas and dreams that you have that have nothing to do with him. He's dangerous to those things. Who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? To whom will the ark go up from here? In other words, we need to kind of move him somewhere else because he's dangerous. Verse 21, then they sent messengers to the people of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to your own town. Period. End of quotation. Notice, they don't tell them that they lost 70 people. They just say, hey, we have the ark. Why don't you guys take it? So the men of Kiriath and Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord. They brought it to Abinadab's, thank you, house on the hill, and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to guard the ark of the Lord. The ark remained at that place a long time, 20 years. Now, 20 years means this, 20 years until the next thing. But now, the ark was actually there about 70 or 80 years. Now, notice, beloved, there is no mention of Shiloh. You remember Shiloh was where the ark and the tabernacle were? And then they took the ark from Shiloh into battle. There is no mention of Shiloh, and there is no conversation about taking it back to Shiloh, because most scholars believe Shiloh was a parking lot. The Philistines had destroyed it. So the ark stays here for, this is in this verse, this last verse, chapter verse 2 of chapter 7, for 20 years. It actually stays longer than that. I will say to you that we, as we do further study, that we'll come to find out that the ark kind of gets just set aside. It's just kind of out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. Because we're going to read in the next chapter how the people had given themselves to the worship of Baal and Asherah. And I'm going to describe those next time about what those are like. They're horrific. If you don't like graphic information, then I encourage you to go to Lubbock Breakfast House instead of coming to Hardcore. So out of sight, out of mind is what happened. Okay. Any questions that you guys want to ask about the chapter before we get into the questions? Okay, let's do the first one. What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send him back to his place. Okay. Question to you. What do you do with the presence of the Lord? What do you do with the presence of the Lord? Do you seek it? Do you avoid it? Maybe I should say, do you seek him? Or do you avoid him? Do you pursue him, or do you pass him off as not necessary? Maybe not important. Maybe what you do with the presence of the Lord is that you just treat it as something that's so mystical, it's too much of a mystery to give attention to. What do you do with the presence of God? You see, the story of chapter 6 makes us wrestle with the reality of God's presence in this world. In fact, chapters 4, 5, and 6 do that. Chapters 4, 5, and 6 are about, the main character of those three chapters is the ark of the Lord. In other words, the symbol of his presence in this world. What do you do with that? What do you do with God's presence? If you'll also notice, in the chapter that we read tonight, God says nothing. There is no word from God. It is just his presence. In fact, I can say that about all three chapters. Chapter 4, 5, and 6. God says nothing. It is all about him being present in this world, in all of his holiness, in all of his power. There is silence, but there is presence. There are no commands, but there is power. What do you do with the presence of the Lord? What do you do daily with his presence? I would invite you to spend some time with that question. What the Philistines did with it was they tried to get away from it. It was too costly to them to stay close. What do you do? Now the next question, verse 4, the Philistines, what guilt offering should we send to him? Now, like I said, that this is the idea that there has been some kind of offense created, that they have this idea accurately that they have offended this God of Israel, and so they need to make things right. Okay, all right. So bouncing off that question, then what comes to me, what I need to ask myself. And because I'm asking myself, I'm asking you, am I doing anything that is offending God? Is there anything in my life, a regular part of my life? I'm making sure it's a part of my life, but it's offensive to God. And I'm not really willing to let go of it. Is there anything like that in your life? Are you doing anything that is offending God? And I'm not talking about trips up and mess ups and mistakes and things like that. Things that you don't mean to do. Maybe you did mean to do it, but it isn't something that's a regular thing, a consistent thing, a pattern kind of thing. I'm talking about those kinds of stuff. Is there anything regularly in your life that you are fostering and cultivating, encouraging, that is offensive to God? Then what should you do? If there's an acknowledgement that I am living in a way, in a certain part of my life, that is offensive to Him, what should I do? I want you to turn with me to Psalm chapter 51. Psalm 51, verses 16 and 17. This is David talking about the Lord, and he says, "You do not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You do not take pleasure in burnt offerings. My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart you, God, will not despise." Let me say to you that the thing that offended God the most from the Philistines was their arrogance. And really what they needed to give Him was not golden tumors and golden rats. What they needed to give to Him was their humility, their humbleness. Now, what is really striking to me is that that theme of humility runs through this whole chapter, the need for it. The need for humility runs through this whole chapter. And beloved, I'll say to you that humility is such an essential quality of the Christian life with Jesus that I really don't think that you can foster any other Christian virtues if you don't have that one in place. In fact, I challenge you to pick up a gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, and take a colored pencil and mark every time you see Jesus exhibiting humility. Now, I did that once. I started with the Gospel of Matthew, and I quit about chapter 4 because all I was doing was coloring Matthew the color of my pencil. It's on every page, almost in every verse. Humility is that essential. What should we offer to God as a guilt offering, as an offering to Him for the ways that we have offended Him or are offending Him? What should we do? Then we offer a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, because that offering He does not despise. Is that what you're offering? Are you offering God humility? Next question. It's the same one. It just runs right down the same theme that I'm talking about. Verse 6. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh did? When Israel's God dealt harshly with them, did they not send the Israelites out so that they could go on their way? And what the priests and diviners are saying to the Philistines is, listen, we got a lesson from Pharaoh and the Egyptians, how they refused to humble themselves before this God, and it cost them severely. And so don't be like them. Learn from their lesson. Approach this God, relate to this God with humility. And again, it's this same echo. I want to say just one thing that I didn't. In the verse before that where it says, make models of the tumors and of the rats that are destroying the country and give glory to Israel's God, perhaps He will lift His hand from you and your gods and your land. Now that word perhaps is a question. There's a question inside that word. Perhaps, maybe, we don't know. We have a question about it, but he might lift his hand from you and your gods and your land. Okay, now, there's a play on words in this verse as well. Give glory to Israel's God. The word glory means heavy. Make God heavy in your life, and perhaps he will make his hand light on you. He will lift his hand. There's a play on that word, you know. And I just want to encourage you. I really don't know exactly how to approach this idea that a play on words where make God heavy and he'll make his hand light. I don't know exactly what I should do with that, but I do know the first part. The first part about making God, you know, giving God glory, making God heavy. You know, there's, you know, when there's something heavy in your life, it's shaping your life. It's moving your life. It shapes you, moves you. The example that I could give you is that I had a surgery on my left wrist. This is a long time ago, and I was after the surgery. They deadened the arm. I won't tell you how they deadened the arm, but that was so weird. But anyway, this whole arm was dead. Just dead as dead meat. It looked like piece of steak. And so it's sitting on my chest, and I'm laying in the bed, and the nurse comes in and she's talking to me, and as she's talking to me, this arm is slipping off my chest, but I can't feel it. And you know, and then it kind of lays off the bed, and then as I'm talking to her, I'm beginning to slide like this, and I literally thought someone was pulling me over in the bed. But what had happened, this arm had slipped off the edge of the bed. And the weight of it was just pulling me, the heaviness of it was just pulling me out of bed. And when I realized it, I had no arm to stop it. So I started reaching for the nurse. Hold on, pull me back. You know. Of course, she dropped everything she had to yank me back into the bed. But this is what heaviness shapes you. It changes you. It moves you. Your life can't go on as normal. This is what glory, giving him glory. This is what make God heavy in your life. Do you do that? Do you do that occasionally? Do you do that regularly? Have you ever done that? Last question, verse 20. And the people of Beth Shemesh asked, "Who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? To whom will the ark go up from here?" Who can stand in the presence of the Lord? Would you look at Psalm 24 with me right quick? Psalm 24. And then I've got to quit and let you get into your small groups. Psalm 24, verses 3 and 4. Psalm 24, verses 3 and 4 says this: "Who may ascend the mountain of the Lord, and who may stand in his holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not trust in an idol or swear by a false god." The one who has clean hands. That means that you're not practicing things that God considers dirty. And has a pure heart. That means that you're a one thing person. That your life is about one thing. Your life isn't about many things. It isn't about grades. It isn't about career. It's not about bank account. It's not about marriage. It's not about children. It's not about you fill in the blank. It's about one thing. That's what that means. That's what a pure heart is. A pure heart is one thing. Who does not trust in an idol In other words, it doesn't look to other things to take care of you instead of the Lord. Like, I don't look to my bank account. I don't look to my children. I don't look to my friends. I don't look to whatever to take care of me. I look to Him. And I don't swear by a false god. In other words, I don't make oaths or commitments to things that are false. That's who can stand in the presence of the Lord. Now, let me be real quick to tell you, beloved, I cannot make myself that way. Neither can you. How I come to have clean hands and how I come to have a one thing heart is that I humble myself moment by moment, day by day, week by week, year by year, decade by decade. I humble myself before Him. Now, there are a lot of other questions in this chapter that we could look at. We're out of time. But I invite you in your small groups to pursue some of these and discuss some of these. But now, you don't have to stick to these questions. There may be other questions that come up. Your small group leader may ask you a question that doesn't have anything to do with this chapter. But you guys, let the Scriptures study you. Don't just let yourself study them. Thank you for tonight. Let's break up into our small groups. Yes, sir, hit me with it.
It says here in the notes down here that the sacrifice of the female cows is in opposition to the wonderful requirement of male sacrifice.
Okay, I can't hear you. Say it again.
So they sacrifice female cows.